Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week this show will address issues such as family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many things that will improve our lives. Having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, for everybody out there, I'm looking for some show ambassadors who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular show. So I want you to know that I truly appreciate it, and this is just another way that we, as a group, can make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now today, we're going to be talking about how the world is changing for women and girls. Our guest, Karina Chocano, has gone back and done archaeology about what happened in the past and how it has shaped women today. Karina is a contributing writer to New York Times Magazine. Her work has also appeared in Elle, Vogue, Rolling Stones, and many other publications. She has been a film and TV critic at the Los Angeles Times, Entertainment Weekly, and Salon.com. Her new book, You Play the Girl, on Playboy Bunnies, Stepford Wives, Trainwrecks, and Other Mixed Messages, was the winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. In You Play the Girl, Karina blends personal stories and powerful analysis, from Bugs Bunny to Playboy Bunnies, from Flashdance to Frozen, or from the 70s to today. She explains how growing up in the shadow of, quote, the girl, taught her to think about herself and the world and what it means to raise a daughter in the face of these contorted reflections. Karina, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you, Alan. Well, thanks for the great intro.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm so glad to meet you. It's very enlightening being able to go through the book and get your take on things. I've really enjoyed it. But I think my first question, and you know, is that, you know, what was the genesis of these essays? You know, were they topics that you'd already been thinking about, or had you just been watching and consuming so much media that they then were brought about these ideas?
Kind of both of those things. It was a very kind of long process, and I guess an organic process. I was a pop culture critic, a staff critic for many years. For about a decade, and I sort of spent my, you know, my work life was mostly spent consuming a lot of mainstream pop culture. But I'm also, you know, I was a comparative literature major. I was always a big reader, and so I, you know, spent my life also reading stories and consuming stories. And so it sort of reached a point, I guess, around 2007, 2008, where I was working at the LA Times, and I was really noticing certain narratives that just were so prevalent, and, you know, both on screen with the sort of rise of the so-called, like, romance comedies, and how the female characters were always sort of relegated to the sidelines even more so than usual, and at the same time in the way that the media even sort of mirrored and perpetuated these stories. And like one of the things that really got to me at the time was the way that there was a sort of moment where all these young pop starlets were sort of crucified and sort of, you know, kind of treated, you know, the whole train wreck idea of like these girls falling apart and the culture kind of going after them in a certain way. Like it really started to get under my skin, and I really just started thinking about all of these things. And there was an interview that I heard, that I read with the actress Isla Fisher, who was asked if she'd gotten a lot of offers to play the lead in comedies. after she kind of stole the show in The Wedding Crashers, and she said, no, because in Hollywood, all the parts are written for men, and you play the girl. So it really just got me thinking about how, you know, it sort of crystallized the idea for me. And after that, I started thinking about writing a book, but it ended up happening sort of slowly. I wrote essays for the New York Times Magazine, and after a while realized I had part of the book underway.
And so came the name, You Play the Girl. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, you know, as a critic, and obviously you're not only watching art, but you're also dealing with the artists. Are you able to separate the art from the artist? And is that getting harder to do in this post-Weinstein or post-Me Too moment?
Well, you know, I think at the time that I was, the essays were first coming together and that I was first thinking about it, I wasn't interacting with artists quite as much as a critic. I was really just going to see films and watching TV. But I had the occasional profile or something that I would do. And also just like I mentioned, it just through the media, you started to see the kind of meta narrative, you know, where say Britney Spears was a kind of a character in a kind of a real life drama that was very much being constructed in the media, you know, and I started to really think about, you know, what is real about this story, what is true about the story, and what isn't, you know, because there was a moment where there was no sort of space around there was no questioning kind of these narratives. Lindsay Lohan going, you know, to court again and again and again and again. It all started to feel like a kind of a real life soap opera that was being shaped by the gossip media. Mm-hmm. And once I started, like you mentioned in the intro, once I started digging, it was a little bit like archaeology. So I started to try to make a separation between the artist and the art, and to see where sometimes even real people are caught up in these narratives and how pervasive these narratives are, and how we have trouble stepping outside of them, even as real people in real life.
You know, you just mentioned a real life soap opera, and just as you were saying that, we have a question, a comment, and a question coming in from a listener. Mm-hmm. When you said real life soap opera, and I looked at this question, I thought this is perfect. It says, "What are your thoughts on the royal marriage of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle?" I'm sure you
go
do,
ahead,
but let me finish it, because they have a comment too. It says, "History and the movie The King's Speech reminds us of a king that had to give up his throne to marry an American. Now there are millions of young girls around the world that watched the wedding and saw a middle-class American woman marry a prince. Do you think this helps or hurts the cause?" And this is from May in Los Angeles.
It's so interesting. I happened to catch it. I woke up, you know, I had insomnia. Then I ended up on Twitter and catching a lot of it live. And it's so fascinating. And I think there's so much there. And it's such a snake eating its own tail, this whole thing, you know, because yes, like I was just reading something this morning about the history of royal marriages to commoners, and how that's evolved, and how even the laws and the mores have evolved. My thought on seeing the wedding, honestly, people might hate me for saying this, but I was a little bit bummed by the whole thing. It felt very, I felt like I was watching a Julia Roberts movie from the 90s. It felt like a Disney movie to me. It was a weird genre mashup that I couldn't wrap my head around, the extreme kind of the mashup of like celebrity and you know, the minister, and then the shots to the royals. It all felt like it reminded me of that Julie Andrews and Anne Hathaway movie about the girl who finds out she's a princess. It felt very much like it was telling the story that these princess movies have been telling for a long time, in which there's a kind of a dream of what a princess is, but at the same time, there's this kind of American notion of what a relatable good girl is, and she is obviously a klutzy or, you know, more humble origins girl from a middle class family, and then she shows these stuffy royals how to be a cool girl. You know, the whole thing is like, I felt like I've seen it so often in the movies, and here it is playing out in real life, and it just felt like a triumph of this very silly story. And I think that it, from my perspective, it hurts more than helps. I think that through stories like that, starting with Pretty Woman, which was a kind of a Cinderella story that's extremely implausible and has all these unexamined, ideas in it, it basically tells girls that, you know, the best thing you can aspire to is to do nothing. It's to have everything in exchange for nothing and to sort of stop, you know, like, it's this end of a story. Like, now Meghan Markle can't work, you know, and presumably she's an artist, she's an actress, you know, but artists don't retire, you know, they're not like looking to clock out, right? It's presumably it's something that you, that you love to do, and that expresses who you are, and that is part of your purpose and your identity, but she has to give that up and has to give up all kinds of other things, I think, including nail polish. I mean, kind of everything that you might choose to do for yourself in order to sort of be this figure of wealth and leisure and adulation. And I think that that story's been told to us so relentlessly now since the early 90s that it's created a whole, I think, really negative fantasy that's really pervasive in our culture, which is, you know, this kind of like absolute, incredible wealth and leisure in exchange for your prettiness. And I don't think that's a good thing.
Well, yeah. And I think you touched on it, but my initial thought, when I saw some clips of it was, wow, did I somehow turn to the Hallmark Channel? Because I'm watching a Hallmark movie, you know?
Absolutely. It was a Disney movie or a Hallmark movie. It was a weird mashup. And of course it's now been, I would say also, it's been so commercialized, this idea. It's like, maybe with, you know, I was a little girl when Prince Charles and Princess Diana got married. And in fact, I grew up in Spain, and I spent the summer in London, the summer before they got married. Like, I was home a week before they got married. So I was kind of in that soup of, you know, leading up to the royal wedding in England. And I think that at the time, obviously, it was a huge, you know, it was a huge television spectacular, whenever that was, in the 80s sometime. But by now, it's basically turned into, you know, I don't know how many viewers they had, but it's basically the Oscars or something. And I think that there's a consciousness of, like, what a money-making spectacular this is. And I don't know, the whole thing feels like it rests on all kinds of things that I think are uncomfortable, and these narratives that are uncomfortable and that are not nearly examined enough, which is just, you know, how certain transactional aspects of marriage, the commodification of women and the commodification of, like, love. And it's really an interesting thing. I was a little bummed out that day. I was like, I sound like such a curmudgeon. It was beautiful, and I'm happy for that. but it still, you know, it troubled me for like 24 hours.
Well, one of the things that's intrigued me about your story is that you also have a daughter, and so there is this now, this thing of, you know, so tell us a little bit about how, like, you know, that there's the books and the movies that you loved as a kid, and you've talked about the fact on how they define you, and me as a father, I think of some of the things that I want to show my sons, you know, of what, you know, I want them to see certain things, and there's other things I'd prefer they didn't. But I'm curious as to, you know, what you're seeing now in your own daughter, and how you're making these decisions on, you know, okay, is this one going to be good for her or is this not? How are you now putting this all together? Because especially now with writing this book, it certainly opened your eyes, as it has many other people's, on how many of these things are affecting us.
Well, I wish I was better at this. Honestly, I'm not the greatest at sort of saying, here's what you should watch and here's what you shouldn't. I mean, I sort of muddle through based on what, you know, she wants to watch. And I think that what's interesting for me is that I think it's really hard in this world to control, barring obviously things that I absolutely would never allow her to watch, because they're, completely inappropriate for her age or whatever. I think that it's really hard to navigate these stories. And my approach, I guess, is more to try to talk to her about what she's seeing and encourage her to think about what she's seeing and encourage her to do something that I think very few students are taught to do anymore, if they ever really were, but certainly now less than before, which is to sort of investigate, like, what's the real story that's being told to you? You know, what is the subtext? Like, not every stories are not just text, and nothing is ever just entertainment. This is a criticism that critics get all the time. You know, you get emails after you write a review of something saying, like, relax. Like, you know, it's a really interesting thing. Like, relax, it's just entertainment. And it's fascinating because it's like, well, you're obviating, like, the need for this job, for one thing. But also, like, it's like asking not to look underneath the surface. You know, it's saying, like, don't look underneath the surface, and sort of the act of looking underneath the surface is somehow a negative thing, an uptight thing to do. Whereas, in fact, it's kind of like, I think we need to think about the fact that in the last 30 years, there's been such overwhelming media consolidation in this country, and all of the information that we consume, whether it's quote-unquote, you know, popcorn entertainment to news, is kind of coming through a narrow pipeline. Until very recently, until new platforms and social media opened it back up, but still there's consolidation in those areas as well. Massive consolidation, as we've seen with, like, Facebook and everything. So we really have to think about, like, what the pipeline is. It's not just what the content is. It's how the pipeline determines what the content is and what that teaches us. I mean, stories have always had a socializing effect. Like, not every culture tells the same stories, or not every time period tells the same stories. Mm-hmm. And the stories that were told, especially since, I would say, the 80s, are, you know, they are a certain kind of story. Our action movies tend toward very imperialist themes, and our love stories tend to be very patriarchal. That's not an accident, you know? So I think that's what's important. It's like, look at what you're seeing, and also then it helps you appreciate the stuff that that maybe tells a different story, or that remarks on the stories that were told. Because that's what's interesting to me, anyway. And yeah, that's what I hope that my daughter can learn, to sort of separate herself, because otherwise you're just a passive consumer, and you're allowing yourself to be shaped and brainwashed in a way into thinking a certain way. And that's a real problem, I think, that we have in this country.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And as you were saying that, I was thinking about a time in which I was sitting down with my sons, and I was explaining the difference between entertainment and indoctrination. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I was explaining, you know, that when they're sending this message, they're trying to indoctrinate you into something, you know, whatever it may be, whatever it is that is what their agenda is. And so, just, you know, if you want something and it's entertainment, you can look at it as entertainment. If you feel that something is is changing the way that you think, or it's trying to indoctrinate you, I want you to question it. You know, look at it.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I think is, you know, and say is like, just question it and question who is telling you what and why, you know, it's really important because I think it's funny. A couple of years ago, we could be having this conversation and sound kind of paranoid, but now we know that it's not paranoid. That there has been, there have been all kinds of crazy things that have happened, agendas, you know, whatever it is, you know, Russian manipulation and Facebook and disinformation being spread during elections. I mean, all these things that have had real effects and have, you know, have actually had real life effects and have reshaped reality in a way that's kind of breathtaking. And we, you know, I think that the way that we used to talk about entertainment until very recently, it certainly when I was a staff critic, was like, oh, don't take it too seriously. You know, it was a kind of a remove, an ironic remove that said like, oh, I know this is kind of a fascist story, but, you know, you can't say that because that's, you look silly, you know. But in reality, it's like, these stories have a lot of power, you know, and they really have the power to shape our point of view. And especially if we're young, I think that's something that people are talking about more now that, for instance, the way pornography has affected, boys' views of girls. Mm-hmm. It has a real life, effect that's really quite negative. Certain expectations of what a girl looks like, of what she'll do, of how she'll act, you know, of what, of who she really is. All of that is, it's more powerful. You know, people say like, oh, I'm a parent and I can control what my kids think. You can't really control them. You can't really protect them, as, you know, from this incredibly pervasive culture. I'm
guessing that whoever it was that said that wasn't really a parent.
Well, I think that they are parents, but maybe they have their head in the sand a little bit how much control they can exert over their children. I mean, look, even if something happens to your child because of some other kid who was not similarly protected, you still can't protect your kid. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
Like, keep your child in a box at home. Like,
right.
There's no.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they'll come across it whether you did, even if you were a wonderful parent who was incredibly thoughtful and careful about what you fed them, you know, they're still going to go out into this very polluted world.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. And there's,
what
and there's
are we
no
gonna
way.
Do about that?
Yeah, you're right. And there's no way that we can keep them from seeing it or learning about it. So you're right. All we can really do is educate them in regards to how to deal with that information when it does come their way.
Right, because on the flip side, I do think that one wonderful thing that's happening now, and it gives me hope for a kind of maybe future, like, disengagement from this kind of cult, you know, narrative, is that I think that we have seen a real flip in terms of how young people see certain things, where they have kind of driven a change in media representation because they've rejected some of the same old things. I'll give you an example. I think that nowadays, for instance, people always say, oh, this generation is different because they reject, you know, they can't necessarily watch a show that's just like all white kids or whatever. But I feel like, I don't know about you, but when I was in my 20s and I would watch Friends, I also felt that it was an incredibly false representation. But there didn't seem to be any room in the culture for, an, you know, it was just very walled off to other points of view. It just seemed completely impenetrable. But now that, like, now certain things have happened to decentralize these stories a little bit, and So now there is a push toward authenticity, I think, that I longed for, you know, as a teenager and 20-something, that now is actually happening. So I think that it is generational, but it's also the fact that, like, a bit of a wall has come down and allowed for reality to, you know, to see through, in a way, a system that used to be so much more centralized.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, I think you're right on target. And yes, when you brought up, you know, that a lot of the comments that people make, oh, well, the millennials this, the millennials that. Well, I think part of it, you know, if somebody's focusing on a negative side, there's an incredible amount of positive, you know, mm-hmm. that is also being brought into our culture that is being steered now by millennials. Mm-hmm. And I'm appreciative of it. So at the same time, when I have, you know, I can be sitting at the gym or somewhere talking to some guy that's closer to my age and I'll say, you know, you're really only looking at one side of this. You know, let's talk about some of these other things that are being done that are incredibly positive.
Yeah, not just that, but, you know, I don't know. I'm a Gen Xer, right? And I remember when I was in my 20s, the media narrative about what Gen X was also very frustrating and limiting to me. And I remember feeling like, what is with this weird generational parsing? And then attributing these characteristics to, like, an age group and then putting it on Time Magazine in this sort of, like, you know, alarmist cover story. You know, the whole thing was like, what is this garbage? Like, this is just made up. And I feel that the same thing happens with millennials. Like, now we put that on millennials and it's all millennials, you know, they're ruining the world. And they used to say that about Gen Xers. And I think that they used to say it about, you know, baby boomers when they were young and hippies and whatever. Like, this is a thing that's been going on for decades where, like, these kind of alarmist ideas and really reductive ideas about generations, which are always way too generalizing and monolithic, turn into, you know, again, it's like these stories that just, you know, kind of like shape reality in these bizarre ways. So now I personally feel like my values and my tastes are much more reflected in the stuff that I'm seeing today. Like, you know what I mean? I never identified with the things that I was seeing on TV as a 20-something. I mean, I would watch Friends and 90210, but as a joke. It was always, you know, there was always with this ironic remove of, like, this is ridiculous. So in a way I'm like appreciative that now I get to see, I remember like when Girls first started, I was a few of my friends from graduate school wrote me and were like, I feel like it's us. And it was like, it was 20 years later, but it was like the reality of what we had seen, you know, we had lived through. So I think it's really interesting to see new stories, break through. And that's a positive. It's a real positive right now.
Yeah, I agree. But in one of the things that, and I'm a big believer in common denominators. And as you went through and we were talking about, you know, what is put out there about millennials or Gen Xers or baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it comes down to, what is the media going to focus on? Who are they going to give a microphone to? And generally, it is going to go towards some sort of a negative or controversial approach to it, rather than really trying to do a very broad approach of, let's talk about all of the great things that have happened as well. But that's not normal for the media. And I think that's something that's carried on now for now, you know, multiple generations of, you know, the old, you know, if it bleeds, it leads type of mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really frustrating to me.
It's really frustrating. And not only is it not focusing on the positive, but, and this is something that I think my book tries to get at a lot, it's focusing on the individual or the group rather than the system and the forces that are creating the conditions for that individual or that group. Do you know what I mean? So
yes.
You can talk about millennials in a certain way, but if you don't talk about, you know, the forces that they're up against, and you're just saying, oh, they're this, they're that, that's just essentializing. And I feel that it's worthless. It's the same as with women. Oh, women are like this, women are like that, men are like this, men are like that. It's like, let's look at what, you know, what do we ask of women? What do we ask of men? What is the system that people are growing up in? What are the boys being taught they have to be? And what are girls being taught they have to be? And what are they being taught? You know, how are they being taught to relate to each other? All these things, whether it's a millennial or a girl or, you know, or whatever group or individual that you're talking about, I really think that we pay very little attention to how we kind of lock people into certain narratives. Also, you know, depending whatever race you are or whatever, we get locked into these stereotypes that are amazingly hard to break free of, even if they have nothing to do with you or your experience.
Couldn't agree more. For everybody out there, we are talking with Karina Chicano. We are talking about You Play the Girl. It's her new book, and it is available everywhere. So stay with us. We're going to be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking about how the world is changing for women and girls. The book is You Play the Girl. We're speaking with Karina Chicano, and we are really touching on some, I think, some incredible subjects, and I'm very, very happy to have her on the show with us. Karina, I, while doing some research for this interview, I read that Roman Polanski commented on the Me Too movement just, this is about 2 weeks ago. And he said, this is the kind of mass hysteria that occurs in society from time to time. Sometimes it's very dramatic, like the French Revolution, the St. Bartholomew Day Massacre, or McCarthyism in the U.S. Everyone is backing the movement out of fear, adding that he thinks it's totally ridiculous. Now, before you comment on it, I need to say something as well. So, personally, I think that associating the Me Too movement with the French Revolution, any kind of massacre, or McCarthyism is just ridiculous. And for those people out there, I know we have younger people out there that don't know who this man is. He was arrested for drugging and raping a 13-year-old girl and then fled the United States after admitting to statutory rape. He's the last person that our media should be giving a microphone to comment about this subject. Karina, what's your take on this response to women that are speaking out against their accusers?
Yeah, I mean, like you're saying, it was a completely, it was just an amazing response. And there's so many aspects of it. First of all, I mean, comparing the French Revolution to McCarthyism, for instance, is so fascinatingly off-kilter. You know, like, he's talking about everything from, like, an illegitimate, you know, politically motivated witch hunt to, you know, this starving populace rising up against tyranny.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it's interesting how he's lumping these things together. But that aside, yeah, I mean, Roman Polanski, it's interesting. You know, Roman Polanski fled the United States and has, you know, been living outside of the United States for, I don't know, since the 70s, I believe. But he, but until very recently, I don't think he faced any consequences as an artist. And, you know, this is one of the interesting things that's coming up now. Like what you said earlier, do we separate the artist from the art? You know, do we still honor and respect someone like Roman Polanski or Woody Allen or until recently Harvey Weinstein as an artist and a cultural figure, even when we know what, you know, the kinds of things that they've done? And what's fascinating to me is, you know, to me, what's happened in the past year is very much rooted in the ability to shift the perspective on the story. And this is sort of what I always, what I really want to talk about in my book, which is when we only get a certain perspective, we only frame stories in a certain way. So it's not that people didn't really know, apparently, about Harvey Weinstein. Apparently everybody knew, or a lot of people knew, and it was a so-called open secret. And that's true of Woody Allen, and certainly Roman Polanski, everybody knew because it was news. for decades, but we didn't have, we still didn't have the frame in which we could talk about it, as being unacceptable. We were still completely rooted in the frame where the genius could get away with it, or the powerful mogul could get away with it, or somehow these things were separate from each other. And I think that, you know, Polanski is obviously, just to psychoanalyze him, like, he's obviously, responding to a shift that doesn't favor him. Mm-hmm. And he's able to say, oh, look, this is hysterical, and now we're going to throw out the whole culture with the bathwater. But the thing is, that's not really true. And, you know, people confuse this idea of, like, examining stories or questioning stories with censorship. And it's not censorship at all. It's really just, I think, putting things up against a kind of a truth barometer. You know what I mean? Like sometimes I think, say, as a woman, you'll go see something and it resonates as untrue. It's just nothing about the characters feels true. And I think most men are used to going to the movies and seeing themselves reflected in some way, even if they're not an action hero. Their perspective and their point of view and their feelings about certain things ring true, you know, but for everyone else, and this is people who aren't white, people who aren't straight, you know, people who aren't men, the most dominant stories tend to ring false, or else you just don't see yourself. The other day I saw something, an interview, and this, I think he was a rapper, said something about his former ex and said, you know, everyone wants to be surrounded by beautiful women. And I thought, and the interviewer was a woman and didn't cut in at that moment, but I thought, it's so interesting. We're so used to hearing that. Everyone wants to be surrounded. Well, not everyone.
Right.
You know, like not at least half the people. And it's fascinating how we just erase that perspective and we only validate one. So I think what Polanski is responding to is the sudden feeling of, you know, earth shifting in a way where the only perspective that was validated and centered is now being questioned. And he reacts in a kind of, you know, he dismisses it. And because that's what the culture has also taught us to do. That's hysterical is a very gendered comment. Dismissed as hysterical, therefore female and stupid and invalid. And it's not surprising in a way, but is it, you know, where will we move past, you know, will more people see him as a kind of a dinosaur? I don't know. I hope so.
I hope so too. Anyway, we have a comment coming in. And as I look at it, and this is coming in from a male. This says, on one hand, I believe that women have more opportunities available to them than ever before. Yet, I believe that more changes are needed to provide an easier path for each generation of girls to find their own true identities and fulfilling their own dreams. Thank you for shining a light on the subject. And this is from Mark in North Carolina. So mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's great. I think that, you know, the first thing I always try to say is like, the first thing that I sort of reject is this essentialism of like, you know, men are this way or a man can't understand or a woman can't understand. I kind of reject that. And so I'm always heartened when men are able to step out, especially since they are in the sort of privileged position and could potentially defend that privileged position, which is what, you know, people who have more power tend to do, want to hold on to it. So I really appreciate it when men are able to step outside and see, you know, see things from another point of view. And that's been the most gratifying thing for me, I think, with this book, is how many men have liked it and recommended it, and also have told me that it opened their eyes to another perspective. And I think that that's what, you know, stories should do, you know, that's what good stories do is put us in other people's shoes. And the idea that's been so pervasive in Hollywood that the only universal quote-unquote perspective is white and male and straight is very damaging, because it makes it teaches everyone that these are the only people that count. And I think that that's
go ahead.
That's what's led to certain things like, say, reduced sentences for people like the Stanford rapist, because the judge says, oh, I see myself in that fine young man. You know, well, that fine young man was raping an unconscious girl behind a dumpster until some, you know, exchange students intervened. So he's not such a great you know. But anyway, I do think that he's right and that there are more opportunities, for sure. But we still have this, we're still coming up against a lot of the same systemic problems. Everything from the pay gap to the lack of affordable daycare or universal preschool, and the idea that the only people who are actually responsible for the next generation of humans are women, you know? Mm-hmm. So we still rely on this idea that, you know, once a woman has a baby, she can just step off. And it's like, that relies on so many assumptions from, mm-hmm. from the idea that she's married to someone who supports the family all by himself, to like the fact that, you know, the idea that she doesn't want to continue doing whatever she was educated to do or dreams of doing. All these things are stories that we don't question enough, and that keep us kind of locked in an old-fashioned view, I think, that does not work for most people in this day and age. In fact, it works for fewer and fewer people in this day and age. You know, the middle class is falling apart. There's not... Yeah. You know, you have to be quite affluent to have a single income family. So why is there no daycare or preschool or help for, you know, families with young children? Why do public schools get out at 3 when the jobs don't? You know, all these kinds of things that we just focus on men and women, and these ideas about what women are at their core and what men are. And these things, I don't know how, you know, I think we need to start separating these stories from our reality.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more. And as you were talking, I had this vision that you and I need to talk in regards to another book about why we're allowing our politicians to decimate the middle class. But mm-hmm. that's another show.
But it's all related. This is all related also to, you know, corporate capitalism and other, you know, big forces, all the big forces. Yeah.
You got it. We actually have more questions coming in. And again, I do want to take the time to thank those that take the time. I know that we have a lot of people that are middle class, that are working, and that send in questions ahead of time, you know, so that we can get them asked, and I want them to know I always appreciate them taking the time to do that. And most of them listen later on; they'll listen in the evening through iTunes or something. So again, it's much appreciated. This question, and which is a comment as well, says, my husband and I had a business together for many years. I ran the marketing and operations, and he managed the financial side. When we would visit clients, and men were across the table, they looked at him and completely ignored me. To my surprise, one day, my husband turned and said, I'd like you to hear Helen's proposal. And then said, trust me, she is amazing. But he paused and followed it with, a brunette disguised as a blonde. So he goes on to say, I wasn't sure if I should be appreciative or insulted, but to this day, that one experience has never left me. It says, thank you for writing this book. I ordered it as soon as I read that you were going to be on the show, and I read it over the holiday weekend and loved it, how beautifully you presented the message that we women struggle with every day. And that's from Brenda in Washington.
Oh, that's so nice. That's incredibly nice. Thank you. That's such a fascinating story and has so many amazing layers.
Twists.
I mean, so many twists. It's really great. I think that is an experience that every woman in every business environment can relate to. What's fascinating is when you started reading it, and the first part was she and her husband run a business together as partners. And my first thought was, this is our current way of thinking about men and women and work and money and domesticity is very new. It's basically like, 150 years old? It's basically a 19th century idea. And it has very much to do with the Industrial Revolution and the rise of corporate capitalism and the creation of an affluent upper middle class, a professional class that kind of divvied up the world again and said, okay, now men are going to go to work and women are going to stay home. And this is what they're going to do at home. And what they were, then all these, this was around the time that mass media was first coming into being in the form of newspapers with photographs and magazines for ladies' home journals and such, because before that, what you had was the kind of thing that she described, where you maybe the family had a farm or an inn or a shop, or people generally tended to work at home as a group, as a family. Or if you were an aristocrat, those rules didn't apply. But nobody worked either. You lived off your rent. This idea of woman at home, man at work is relatively new. And, we treat it like it's been this way since the beginning of time. And that's absolutely not true. So these attitudes, the attitude of speaking over the woman in the meeting or ignoring her or assuming that the husband is the person that you speak to and not her, is also fairly new. We talk about these things as traditional, but they're actually not as age old, I think, or they're different. It's a different approach. So it's fascinating. And then on top of that, the comment about the brunette disguised as a blonde is fascinating. Again, the stereotypes.
It's really hard
to say, do you want to kiss the guy or punch him? Because honestly, it's so confusing, and women have to manage all these things where you're grateful that he realized it and stepped in, and yet appalled at how it has to be managed, because it's just crazy. It's crazy to me that this is still the way that it is.
Yeah. Well, and again, I couldn't agree more, and I kind of had the same feeling as I was reading it, which was at first I wanted to congratulate him, and then in the very next sentence I'm like, and there you went, So, well, time has flown by. This has been great. I appreciate you so much for taking the time to come on the show. I mean, for everybody out there, again, the book is called You Play the Girl. Highly recommend it. Available everywhere. So, Karina, again, thank you so much. And actually, I just want to give one last question, and we literally have like 30 seconds left. But if you could present one change, if you could go to the United Nations and stand before them and say, I want the power to make one change on this subject, what would it be?
Oh, easy. It would be 50-50 by 2020. It would be media is too important to be left to one tiny sector. We need more equal representation in media. We need media to reflect the world as the world actually is. Right now, it's a very distorted view.
Perfect. I love it. Again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Don.
All right. Take care. And for everybody out there, please be sure. All right, everybody, please be sure to put on your calendar next Monday when our special guest will be Dr. John Gray, the author of the most well-known and trusted relationship book of all time, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. In fact, USA Today listed his book as one of the top 10 most influential books of the last quarter century. So, and in next week's show, he will discuss Staying Focused in a Hyper World, which is, again, one of his books. And it contains the latest research and news on ADHD, why it exists, and how to cure it. He will also speak a little bit on his newest book, The Boy Crisis. And please, if you get a chance, visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or better yet, subscribe to our show through iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people and be greatly appreciated. The next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by and check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and continue to spread the word. Be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.